Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Hi, John. And we are so excited. Shireen is not with us today, but we have on the political left, Ben McAdams.
Great to be with you. She leaves big shoes, but it's fun to be here.
Shireen does leave big shoes. She's good at what she does. But I'm so appreciative of you, Ben, and always appreciate what you do. Guys, let's talk. There's a lot of news out there, but let's talk. Let's talk about the Olympics.
Tell me about the trip you went on. Italy? I was there for a wedding. Why were you there?
Yeah, that's right. You had a fun experience there. I was there as an international organizing committee observer. We have a lot of people from our state over there right now observing the games
as guests
of the IOC.
So you were there in an official capacity.
Yeah, but not with my role at the University of Utah or the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute.
Or both sides of the aisle.
But I chair the Olympic Legacy Foundation Board. So this is the board that oversees our venues, you know, the Bob and Luge run.
Keep yourself out of trouble.
The ice skating.
You always got to have something going on.
The speed skating, all that kind of thing.
But so more meetings, not so much partying, it sounds
that's
like.
That's right. I went to one event. It was ice hockey, women's ice hockey. I saw the Czechs play the Swedes. No, the Swiss. Yeah, it was cool.
And so what do we have in store for us here in Utah?
Well, you know, the thing that I would share with listeners, and you guys can hit me on a little bit, but it's pretty amazing to be part of the Olympic family. Not many people are that. That's cool. Mm-hmm. It was a big takeaway for me is that, you know, as we project for the games, get ready for the games, we represent the United States of America. And somehow in my Utah context, I just keep thinking about Utah
it's
and
all
Salt
about
Lake
Utah.
City.
Yeah, America, it's, really? It's
yeah,
all about
it
Utah.
It is the USA. And that's an honor and a huge responsibility, especially right now, given the state of our world and of our country. Of course, it's a few years out, but our opening ceremony has to project our ideals as Americans, I believe.
As we welcome the world here.
Yeah, so that was a big takeaway for me.
Well, we nailed it last time we did it.
That's so right.
Can we nail it again?
Yeah, and if you think of it, a lot of people think of this, but the Olympics last time was about our introduction to the world, a sort of a coming out party.
Yeah.
We don't need that anymore.
It was also post 9/11.
Yeah.
We'll,
coming together.
How will America respond post 9/11?
So. Yeah, so 2034, in my judgment, is going to be more about a time of, you know, bringing together the world community at a time of a lot of unrest. And Italy did their part there. I don't know, do you guys watch opening ceremonies?
Yeah.
I did not.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, I mean, it was all about peace and unity and harmony. And the harmony angle was their great composers and their great art and their great architecture, the balance, the design that goes into those things. And they really celebrated Italy, which I think is really cool. That's what you want from a home, you know, country. And so we got to do that for the United States. And so I keep thinking about, you know, our national mission statement, the pursuit of life, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
That's where I want to be. So kind of fun.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That'll be an honor.
And you came home early. They wouldn't let you stay out there.
I was there for almost a week. But, you know, you take two travel days out, so I'm only 4 or 5 days on the ground. But right. I'm in Milan. I don't know how many people are part of the official delegation that the IOC welcomes as observers. But we had people from the University of Utah that are seeing the Athletes' Village because we, of course, have that. We had people that are looking at opening ceremony because we host that and the closing. Our UDOT director was there. Our director of the UTA was there because transportation is such a big deal. So,
Well, they talked about this being the first time they had, quote unquote, two host cities. So what does that mean?
They called it widespread Olympics, the first widespread is how they described it. And they have, you know, not just one Olympic cauldron, but, you know, two or three. They have not one Olympic village, but more than that. So that I didn't.
There were like 4 hours, you said, between
Cortina and Milan.
Okay.
And I didn't like that, right? Our games are so compact. You can make the argument that everything's within 45 minutes of the Athletes' Village, maybe an hour if you want to put in traffic. But our Olympics are more compact than anybody's. We're ideal for the games. But we have our challenges, right? Because you still have to subsidize some of the venues. You know, speed skating doesn't pay for itself. Certainly the bobsled doesn't pay for itself. So you have to figure out ways to make the financials work.
And you got to get some snow.
Yeah, we were over 60 degrees yesterday here in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
64
is what
I heard.
It was kind of sad. I flew over the Alps, right? They're just stunning, obviously, and they've got plenty of snow this year. And I'm on that direct flight from Charles de Gaulle, so from Paris here. But by the time you reopen up the, you know, the window shades and you look out and there's just not much here. It's like, that was downer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to something else, you guys, that's of interest. Talking about big events, we had the Super Bowl. I don't know if you guys watched it, but the halftime entertainment's getting some news.
Well, first of all, I did watch the game. It's usually the only NFL game that I watch. Actually, it was the second one
this
year.
How exciting was it?
It was good. It was actually kind of
started off. Who are you rooting for, Ben?
The Seahawks.
Okay.
I like to root for the underdog. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm a Utah Democrat, so I always choose the underdog. But it was started off slow, but it was a fun game. But for many in the political world, the highlight of the game was the halftime show, right?
And how controversial was it really?
You know, I mean, it wasn't. I liked it. I will say Bad Bunny, I guess I'm old. I didn't know of him before the controversy, and it's not necessarily my type of music, but it was actually a pretty entertaining show. The choreography was amazing. The symbolism was rich. You know, it really, for me, I saw a unifying message of we are the Americas and putting forward a really positive image.
So I saw a little bit of the halftime show. Just for disclosure, I used to live in Puerto Rico. I lived there for a couple years, served an LDS mission there. And so, you know, the sugarcane fields are not strange for me. This is kind of a normal thing when I was living down there. I was living right next to them. And so what I saw was farming, a lot of Puerto Rican culture coming through, a celebration of marriage. My understanding is the couple that actually got married. During the halftime show, that was actual real marriage that took place. And so to a certain extent for me, like you, I didn't know the singer at all. I'd never heard of him before they made the announcement. And I looked at this as the ultimate punking of America, that he came through with something that was so, you know, all American or definitely all Puerto Rican, which is an American territory, celebrating things that are important to America, that he was like punking everybody that speculated about what he was going to do and how he was going to approach it.
Interesting. Yeah. I'll say, I mean, I represent as much of the political center, political right as I can on this. I have someone on my team here at the Gardner Institute who has, you know, Puerto Rican heritage, and she was just over the moon about how fun it was to see her culture celebrated. That meant something to me. I also really appreciated the way the younger set gets to see it, you know, and I'm like you, Ben. I don't listen to Bad Bunny, but my son does.
Yeah.
He likes it a lot.
Yeah,
he likes.
Yeah.
I guess it's a, you know, number one, you know, streaming artist, whatnot.
Of course, I had to go through the annual reminding folks, Puerto Ricans are Americans.
Yes.
They've been citizens for more than 100 years.
Yeah.
And folks that were upset about that it was in Spanish. It's like, well, think of the NFL and think of who they're marketing to.
Yeah,
they're thinking to all those Spanish-speaking
folks. They're going to Madrid. They're going to Mexico City. But I will say it was just a bit odd to me that there wasn't English, you know, spoken during that halftime entertainment. It just threw me off just a tad. Mm-hmm. But our president didn't like it. He called it a mess of a show, I think, a mess of a halftime show, a slap in the face to our country. And Ben, there was an alternative show. You knew about that. What do you know about that?
Allegedly family friendly.
Yeah, Talking Point USA had a show.
Turning Point.
Okay. Yes. Turning Point USA had a show that was headlined by Kid Rock. There were some other artists in there. It was just all Americana, I think, is what they billed it at. I thought it was kind of ironic that they billed it as this family friendly alternative. Kid Rock is not family friendly. I do understand his lyrics, and they are in English, and some of them are pretty offensive, you know.
Okay.
And just saying. Yeah, just saying. So, you know, I think.
And these halftime shows really aren't known for being family friendly over the years, anyway.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, whether it's in Spanish or English, this is, you know, these are performing artists who are provocative by design, I suppose.
I'm reminded of what was the famous saying about the wardrobe malfunction that happened during
Jackson.
The Super Bowl.
Yes.
You two, let's talk for just,
well,
go ahead.
I just
want
to go back
more
to the slap in the face of our country. This is one of our territories. This is part of our country.
Mm-hmm.
We should be willing, whether it's some state or otherwise, we should be willing to celebrate the culture of part of our country.
Mm-hmm.
And so many previous performers have not been American, and it's not always been in English, right? Didn't Pavarotti performed as part of a super, and it was, nobody complained that it was in Italian. So, you know, I think we need to look ourselves in the mirror as a country and say, like, what are we opposed to?
Okay. This one's a hard one to talk about, but we had the news break about this clip, this social media video that had, you know, a racist clip of our former president, Barack Obama, and his wife. Displayed them as apes, And this had so many ripples that eventually, you know, I'm seeing Senator Curtis saying this is not cool. Even Burgess Owens ultimately saying first, oh, it's okay, and then saying, oh, this was a staffer, and then eventually saying people make mistakes. How did you read that, John?
I think it's you can't defend it. Mm-hmm. It's either blatant racism or utter incompetence. There's no way you can defend it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to call it what it was. It was racist and racist stereotype that has no place and for any of us, let alone the president of the United States. And, you know, what was sad to me was the lack of an apology, the lack of a recognition that this was wrong and, mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
and the tone that sets.
And so I'm going back to show clips where comedians portrayed George W. Bush or, you know, Donald Trump as apes or, you know, monkeys, whatever it might be, but still, at the end of the day, you can't defend this.
And, I mean, this is
indefensible.
Yeah, this harkens back to a period in time where, you know, in order to justify slavery, in order to justify Jim Crow, efforts were made to portray African Americans as not human, right?
Mm-hmm.
And dehumanizing, and it's dehumanizing, and that was the intent, and that's, you know, it is a loaded history that, mm-hmm. you know, was racist from the beginning, and it has no place in civic dialogue.
Representative Owens represents me, and the quote we have from him is that the imagery, this is ultimately he got to this point, was wildly offensive and inappropriate, and as a black man, I find it especially troubling. It never should have been shared or even created, and I'm glad it has been taken down. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad he got to the right place.
Republican Senator Tim Scott, who's also black, described it as the most racist thing I've seen out of the White House.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
let's take a short break, and we'll be back to talk more some local news. I've got Ben McAdams on the left, John Dougal on the right, and I'm Natalie Gochner. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We'd love to hear from our listeners like you. If you'd like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Once again, that's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. John Dougal on the right.
Ben McAdams on the left.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Happy Valentine's to you guys this week.
Happy Valentine's.
I have an anniversary coming up.
Saturday. Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah. That's
What year is this for you?
It'll be 35.
35.
Yeah.
Okay, and coming up for me will be 37.
We just celebrated 26 on February 4th.
Look at us. Yeah. Look at us.
There you go. You don't have any grandkids, though, do you?
No.
Yeah. Okay. We've got that joy of grandkids. Yeah.
In the news, though, you've got the famous Robert Indiana sculpture, Love, the red L-O-V-E, that for so many years was it in Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, now on the University of Utah campus. This is the good work of Jonathan Friedman, who helps with art collection, and the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. And I'm so happy to, you know, welcome this incredible sculpture to our campus.
Because, I mean, this is one of those things. For a guy like me, it's like, that's a lot of money for that.
Yeah, well, you have to recognize.
And I'll admit, I'm not really an art guy, so.
Yeah, you have to recognize, though, that the University of Utah has multiple functions, right? Our main roles are teaching and research and patient care and service, but we're also home to the state's arboretum.
And promoting the color red.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We're home to the Utah Natural History Museum, and we are the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. So we have that in our mission. And we have a budget to purchase art and work with art. Donors put up $2.5 million for this. And then we have a public art funding that allowed us to do another $2 million to get this sculpture. But when you start thinking about what it means in the collective conscience and that they're going to take the photographs of it and the history of it, I think it's a really wonderful addition to our state's public art.
And why was it going, if you will, on the market?
Well, this was Utah being very shrewd and seeing that it was being auctioned off and figuring out a way to get that sculpture. And I think you're going to see more. I'll just say that. And I don't mean just with the university, but I think you look at what we've done out at the airport with, you know, showing these welcoming and this public art. And I think as you lead up to the Olympics, you're going to see more public art in this state. And I think it's a beautiful thing. Now, John, are you critical of it?
I just look and I go, $4.5 million. And when you say $2 million from public funding for the arts just makes me go, why? Why? Yeah. I mean, if donors want to donate, and hey, God bless America, more power to them. That's where it's like, okay, public funding to me implies taxpayer funding. which means taxes were higher than necessary.
I love building a sense of community, a sense of identity, a sense of place, you know, and I actually think those things in the long term really provide a societal benefit. Well, you know, if people feel connected to the community where they live, they identify it with it, whether it's tourists who are coming here and see this as a valuable place to come, or just residents who say, this is my hometown, this is who I am. And, you know, look at this, the whale in Salt Lake City and how that has driven identity and connection and discussion and that. Those things just build
emotion.
Mm-hmm. It builds a civic fabric that in the long term, I think, pays for itself.
I loved President Randall's quote about how universities are not only about inspiring students' intellect, which we're doing plenty of, but we also teach about emotion. And, you know, whether it's dance, whether it's other performing arts, you know, whether it's graphic design, we do these things. And so I'm excited to have it. Okay.
And where is it going on campus?
It's right by the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Yeah, you can't miss it up there. So, and it's sort of central campus. So, okay, well, let's take a second and talk about data centers, guys. You okay with that? There's a lot of talk right now.
Do we have enough power for that?
Yeah, that's what the talk's about. And it's interesting, you know, we record both sides of the aisle, but in my professional world, just 20 minutes ago, I'm chatting with an economist about what the increased demand for power is going to do to electricity prices and how difficult that's going to be for inflation over the medium term for our country, because this data center drama is real. And the demand for data centers is so high, and they have
demand
to have
for
power.
Data centers, demand for data, the demand for data is even increasing greater than we expected.
Yeah.
They're saying AI is 10 times what just basic queries were in the past.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And look at what it takes. These are regulated industries, and so therefore—
With long lead times.
Long lead times.
Like to energy,
permit.
Energy.
Yeah, to permit and to have it. And then you've got all sorts of grid.
Government approval of setting the rates and— The ratepayers have to cover the costs if something
goes wrong. Complicated.
Grid
connectivity issues. And I think Utah's well positioned in so many ways, but we're going to feel this. And we have a regulated utility in Rocky Mountain Power that provides so much of our electricity. We also have a lot of munis, mm-hmm. municipalities. I live in Murray. We have our own power company. But get ready, everyone.
You know, we all use these technologies, so we're all guilty of driving the demand that we talk about. This isn't coming from nowhere, right? It's coming from each of us on our mobile devices.
Whether we
on
do
our,
it directly or indirectly.
Yeah, we're consuming this. I think the important thing is to be out in front of it as, you know, policymakers, whether it's a state or federal level, to be out in front of it. The burden of these data centers that are being used nationally or globally shouldn't be borne by the community where those data centers go. So whether it's requiring or sustainable, solar, wind, geothermal energy, part of the reason that Utah is an attractive place for this is we have really in the Delta area some interesting geothermal assets, the ability to create energy. But I think
power lines.
But we need to just make sure that this is done in a way that no individual community is bearing the burden of higher energy bills and the infrastructure cost.
The companies should be bearing the cost.
That's right. And it should be then spread across the users.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the key things, Senator Cotton has a proposal that I really like, which is, okay, if you're not connected onto the grid, and so you're meeting the needs of these data centers independent of the grid, then you're not regulated. Mm-hmm. And these are sophisticated companies that should be able to do sophisticated deals. And it's like, that's a wonderful idea to get out from under the regulatory environment and to show the ratepayers you're not going to bear their price. Yeah. The companies are going to bear it.
Keep an eye on Box Elder County and Brigham City in this regard. Not for data centers, but for power. And we know that the governor's talked about his Operation Gigawatt and some of the nuclear power potential there. But there's natural gas pipeline that has available natural gas, and that's what you need to go make this happen in the short term. So keep an eye. Okay, guys, let's talk.
Inside scoop right there.
In my world, you're always like finding these different things. The other place we're talking a lot about is Cedar City and Iron County.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of things starting to look like that's a place that's going to have a lot of growth. Ben, I'm really interested in your take on Proposition 4 and what's happening with all of these signature packets and where the legislature's at. Give us your quick
So they have until February 15th to turn in the signatures that they've gathered. This is the initiative to repeal Proposition 4. So it's using the same path that is how Proposition 4 got on the ballot through gathering signatures, and then you put it to the voters, and then the Utah voters approved it. So the Utah GOP is leading this effort to repeal it through the same path. Mm-hmm. Now, the legislature has set the bar very high. It is not easy to get a ballot initiative.
And they're experiencing that.
And they're experiencing mm-hmm. that. So you have to get, you know, certain percentage of signatures statewide and in respective Senate districts. And mm-hmm. it looks like at this point, so they have until February 15th to submit their signatures. They are woefully under, so who knows?
Unless there's something we don't know.
Yeah, unless there's something we don't know. And mm-hmm. But... you know, it looks like at this point they will not get their signatures. We will know next week at this time if they, I guess they'll have to turn them in. The clerks will then have some time to count those signatures.
Well, and one of the other things that comes into play is down in Utah County, the county clerk identified potentially fraudulent signatures mm-hmm. and turned that over to the county attorney for possible prosecution. So,
yeah, you can't make this stuff up, meaning the twists and turns. Now, Utah Republican Party Chair Rob Axon, I think very highly of Rob. I think he's...
great guy and a straight shooter from every dealing I've ever had.
He's articulate. He's a good representative of these things. But if they don't get these signatures, it's kind of a bad look.
Yeah, I mean, it shows
there's not public support.
Well, it shows how much support there was for Proposition 4 mm-hmm. originally, and it mm-hmm. shows there's not support for repealing it. Now, I wouldn't go that far.
It just shows the complexity of getting all the signatures and mobilizing.
It takes a lot of grassroots swell of energy to get the signatures to get something on the ballot.
There's a side path, though.
Yeah, there is a backup plan that I would expect to see come into play. So if they do not get their signatures, and maybe you see this in addition, but the legislature has the ability to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot without going down the signature path. So this, instead of repealing Prop 4, part of the reason that Prop 4 has teeth is because the state Supreme Court said the legislature tried to repeal Prop 4 before, and the Supreme Court came
alter it.
And the Supreme Courts came in and said, you can't just an initiative that's adopted by the voters, you can't just repeal it. There's some constitutional rights vested in this ballot initiative. And so the other path the legislature has is to put of their own accord an amendment of the Constitution on the ballot for the voters to approve that would then give them the ability to do what the Supreme Court said they could not do, which is to repeal it of their own.
So this legislative session, they put that on the ballot
and the voters will have to approve it in November.
This November.
Okay. And I think you might expect to see that whether or not they get their signatures, because that is much broader. It'll allow them to rescind any ballot initiative, mm-hmm. Prop 4 and others that they don't like, really gutting the ability of the voters to exercise their rights to direct democracy. That's best from statehood in mm-hmm. the Utah Constitution.
Yeah.
One of the key things, I think, for a lot of voters, they're looking at Prop 4, and it sounded good in theory, and then mm-hmm. when they saw it implemented, they were like, that is not what I was voting for. Mm-hmm. When they saw the map that the judge adopted, mm-hmm. I think they were going, that was not the process. That was not the approach that was pitched. We were pitched the concept of competitive races, and that map will not give competitive races.
Mm-hmm. John, you and I have talked about this, but there's just like overreach, then overreach, then overreach, then overreach. Where does the political middle get like just some common sense things done, you know? I keep mentioning I want my daughter's congressional district to be in the same district as her library.
Yeah.
Is that too much to ask?
I know.
Okay, Ben, I'm interested. I'll start with you. But you guys are both attorneys.
Down where I live, I mean, Alpine and Highland, the map split us, and we're married at the hip on everything. Police, you know, shopping center, you know, the grocery store, et cetera, schools. But we got split.
Well, and that was really at the root of Prop 4, was to say you can't split cities and counties.
Well,
more
communities
than,
of interest.
Yeah. And so, you know, ultimately, I'd love to see the legislature adopt a competitive map. The legislature has not adopted competitive maps. They've gerrymandered to protect and preserve their own power. And so, you know, they are...
Their Map C was much more competitive than the map the judge adopted.
But it didn't follow the guidelines that Prop 4 put on the table. You know, they...
Overreach.
Yeah.
Hey, we only got about a minute left. You guys are both attorneys. Our state has passed a law, and now the governor has signed it to expand the number of Supreme Court justices. Ben, I think of you as a Columbia-trained attorney.
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
The court... And the Chief Justice of the court said that this was not something they needed. There's not a backlog of Supreme Court decisions. Where there is a backlog is at the circuit court level. And so they asked to expand those. That the legislature, this seems to be an affront by the legislature on the court because the court has held them to account on a couple of decisions that they don't like.
Yeah.
And so it
That's
seems
how
pretty aggressive.
It. John, anything you want to add there?
I was just going to add that basically the court has various issues and that they have failed to address over the years. The legislature is very frustrated with them, and the legislature is willing to step in and fix problems, whether or not the court fully recognizes that they have problems to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see. Did you see what Glenn Beck said about it?
He didn't like it.
He called it an overreach and said this in a republic, there's separation of powers, and this is, you know, these are worth protecting.
Yeah, an unexpected move from him. Well, that's all the time we've got, but a great discussion. Thanks for joining us, Ben. John, always good to chat with you. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Thanks, everybody, for listening.